There's a book of, they're called cases. It's a book of stories collection. It's called a Shoyuroku, the Book of Serenity, is how it's translated. It's similar to the Blue Cliff Records, if you've heard of those, or the Mumlan Khan, a collection of stories of sometimes conversations and sometimes just a few words from the history of this, of people who practiced before us. And I'd like to return to the first story of the Shoyuroku. It's called The World Honored One Ascends the Seat. The World Honored One is an epithet or a term used to describe the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. And the seat, in this case, is the teaching seat. So he ascends the seat, he comes to teach, or he comes to the place where he will be teaching. So here's the case. One day the World Honored One ascended the seat. Manjusri was his attendant at that time, his assistant, his attendant. Manjusri struck the gavel. And said, "Clearly observe, the Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus." Then the World Honored One got down from the seat. End of story. That's it. Does everyone understand?
No.
Manjusri, later in his life, was a kind of celestial bodhisattva. He embodied wisdom. And sometimes in a zendo, instead of the Shakyamuni Buddha, sometimes there'll be a separate building or a separate room called a Buddha hall where you do the service. But where you do meditation, you do it with Manjusri. And Manjusri embodies wisdom, seeing things clearly as they are. And so, in the Zen, traditionally in the Zendo, the Buddha or the Bodhisattva that holds the center of that place is Manjusri. And sometimes he'll be holding a sword, and sometimes a sword and a rope. The sword is to cut through delusion, to cut through mistakes or obscurations, and the rope is to bind up the kind of and you could call them the enemies or the difficulties of the way, the mara, which one of them is doubt, one of them is there's many of these sort of, one of them is pride. So Manjusri is kind of a busy guy in the sense that he's like a janitor in a way. He takes care of a business. So he's often the Buddha that sits in the middle of a zendo. But at this time, the Manjushri is Buddha's attendant. He's his jisha, and he struck the gavel, struck the stick, the announcement stick, and said, clearly observe, the Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. Thus word is kind of a loaded word. It thus means as it is, things as they are, the truth, unobscured reality, unobstructed and undifferentiated truth. So Manjushri actually kind of spoke for the Buddha in a way. He kind of said, he kind of finished the Buddha's talk before the Buddha even finished. He said, this is it. And the Buddha just left. It was finished. There's a verse that follows this. Usually there's a case, and then there's a kind of commentary verse that follows each one of these cases. And the verse goes like this. The unique breeze of reality, do you see it? Continuously creation runs her loom and her shuttle, weaving into the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of this spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. So how did Manjushri leak?
I think he expected Buddha to say something.
And Buddha did say something. This word leaking is a classical, from old Buddhism, is a classical term. The Sanskrit is called asarava. And asarava means, it not only means to leak, it means to have outflows. It means to make a mess. It means to spill out. It means to overflow. The definition of an arhat, the definition of someone who's sort of got it in classical Buddhism, of an arhat is someone who has stopped outflows. The outflows have ceased. These outflows are also called, sometimes they're called cankers. They're called effulents. Effulents? Things that you kind of make what? You make a self. You make a personality. you make a description, you make a view, you make a problem being, you know, expressing a particular self rather than expressing life itself. There's two ways to leak. One way is to leak as if a bucket has a hole in it, and there's a hole in the bucket, and you leak energy, you leak vitality by trying to be on, trying to be something, trying to be separate, trying to be Mike, you know, trying to be Cliff. You can leak by, there's various sort of classical definitions of how you leak. You leak by it's called, one is called Kamasrava. Asrava is the term for leaking. Kamasrava is the leaking of karma, of activity. So certain activities, self-serving, selfish activities, self-interest activities, self-making activities, can cause you to leak. And you can also leak by what's called bhavasrava. Bhav is being, like becoming, by trying to hold on to things. So you hold on to a view, a particular way of thinking, tightly, or you hold on to just your bicycle, you know, too tightly, or you hold on to your idea of what other people should be doing or not doing. You hold on to anything. And there's a negative quality to that too, a negative sense of bhavasrava, a negative aspect, which would be the kind of leaking in the sense of how would you do it? Of giving up, you could say. Like someone who just got completely discouraged and wanted to commit suicide. That would be the negative aspect of bhavasrava. And then there's a very important one that comes up for many of us. It's called dithasrava. Dith means, strictly speaking, it means wrong view, but it also means just to have a view. So you can leak, you can drain yourself. You cannot arrive at your full potential by having a view or an opinion or an attitude about something. That's another way to leak. And then the last one is called visya-asrava, and that's simply the leaking of just ignoring something, ignoring what's actually going on, ignoring what's going on with yourself or around you. So you can leak from the bottom of the bucket. But there's another way to leak too, and that's leak. You can leak by kind of overflowing. You know, the bucket can just flood. So you can be flooded with a view, or you can be flooded with attachment to most commonly sensual desires, but attachment to anything. You can be flooded with a sense of being a person, or being an entity, or being on, or having a title, you know. So in this case, in this commentary, in this verse, it says, basically, the unique breeze of reality. Do you see it? Everything is functioning. Everything is interconnected and functioning just as it is. Do you see it? Yes, you see it. It's there. It's visible. It's always available. Continuously, creation runs its loom and shuttle. Things function. Things are taking care of themselves. The way is unfolding. Life is continuously going on. And in this ongoingness, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. So into all this history, our personal history and the history of our species and the history of this earth, newness, new life is always coming forward. Incorporating the forms of this spring, of this moment, of this time, all this is being woven into this ancient brocade of life. And it's wonderful. But still, what shall we do about this leaking, you know, about this problem? Manjusri pointed and said, "This is the truth." He pointed, and that this was so inappropriate at the time that the Buddha just said, "Forget it, I'm out of here." And yet, we have to say something. Knowing full well that no words can reach it. It's interesting kind of paradox that we come to this particular activity with a certain aspiration, a certain intention. Whether we acknowledge it to ourselves or not, there is the impetus of a certain aspiration. In Sanskrit, this is called chetana. Chetana means volition. But it also means direct association with something. And it means a kind of like attraction to something. So we have formally, we might have a vow. We've taken a vow to follow away, or to be married, or to stay with a job. That's one expression of an aspiration, of chetana. Or we could even call it will. We choose to do something. We actually have chosen to do something. So, even though we understand the kind of formless quality of this practice, we have to acknowledge that there's a certain amount of choice that came into what we're doing and why we're here. We actually chose to do this practice. And it's not easy. This is not an entertaining time. This is a time for self-reflection and this is a time for coming home. And like Cliff talked about last Sunday, it's a time to check in. To check in with the four foundations of mindfulness, to check in with our body as it is, to check in with our sensation or feelings as they are, to check in with our mind, with our mental states, with our mind as it is, and to check in with our mental formations, with actually what we're thinking. So we have to acknowledge that we've chosen to be here. This is choice. This is cetana. This is an aspiration. This is a expression of our aspiration. And yet, when we come here, there's a kind of quality to the practice that says, don't meddle. Do not meddle. The way is all pervasive. The way is complete as it is. Don't meddle with it. Don't meddle with your thinking. Just see your thinking as it is. Just see your body as it is. Don't meddle. Don't try and fix it. Don't try and make it better. Just be with it. So it's interesting because we have these two sides. We have the side of aspiration, of will, of trying to be present, or trying to be better, or trying to arrive. And yet we also have this quality in our practice that says, don't meddle, just be with it. So what shall we do about Manjushri's leaking? Everything, the complete breeze of reality, everything is perfect just as it is. And yet, what this actually says is that even though everything is functioning just as it is, and spring is adding, the present moment is adding to this wonderful brocade of reality, still, we can make a problem. We can mess it up. We can obscure beauty. We can obscure truth. So what do we do about this leaking? Anyone have any ideas?
Don't meddle.
Don't meddle. It's interesting when we sit, we notice the effluent momentum of our life. We notice our, because we have chosen to sit still for a moment and take a break from our animate nature, we notice our desire to move, our sort of our vitality to be animate. And when we sit down and we notice and we practice quieting our mind, we notice instead how active our mind is, how busy sometimes our mind is. It's said that about Manjushri. If there had been someone called a Sandaiva person, A Sandaiva person is someone, Sandaiva is a Sanskrit word that means someone who is a sovereign equal. If there had been a Sandaiva person to the Buddha, there wouldn't be any need for Manjushri to strike the gavel. A few weeks ago, we had a wonderful session with Kokyo from Santa Cruz Zen Center, and Kokyo talked about the fascicle, the Dogen fascicle, Yuibutsu Yobutsu, only a Buddha and a Buddha, only a Buddha with a Buddha. This is like the Sandaiva person, a Buddha with a Buddha totally can negotiate this way. If there had been a Buddha with that Buddha, there'd be no need to say something, to say, here it is, here's the truth. The founder of this particular path of practice, his name is Dengshan Langji, Tozan Ryokai. When Dengshan was a young man, he studied with Nan Quan and Nan Chuan. And he... Nanchuan was preparing an offering, a memorial offering for his teacher, who was Matsu. And Matsu was this venerable teacher who had died, and Dengshan was in the assembly. He was a newer monk, and he was in the assembly. And Nanchuan said, "Well, we've prepared all this food, all this wonderful ceremony for our departed master Matsu. Do you think he will come? Do you think he will arrive? Do you think he will be present here?" And there was an assembly of all these monks, and no one could answer him, but this young monk came forward and said, "He will come if he will come forward if he has a companion." So Matsu will come forward and receive the offering if Matsu is there, if a companion comes forward, if a Buddha meets a Buddha. Sandaiva person is someone who can sit down with the Buddha and talk about salt or horses, can just chit-chat with the Buddha. A Sandaiva person is someone who is not afraid to meet a Buddha as a Buddha.
But he is not the Buddha. Sandaiva person is not the Buddha.
You could say he's on the same level as a Buddha. He is a Buddha.
He's a Buddha.
So, we have this issue with our good intentions, our chetana, our volition. And the admonition not to meddle, not to leak. What's interesting about the Buddhist way is often they do not describe, it's not described at all what enlightenment is, or what realization is, or what actualization is, or what awakening is. There's no description of it. What is described in Buddhism is what it's not. What Buddhism talks about is what obscures reality, or what obscures truth. But what is reality and what is truth is just whatever is happening when it is unobscured, when it is unobstructed, when there is no leaking. So to say it is this, for Manjushri to say it is thus, is leaking for Manjushri. If you go through the history of Buddhism, you'll find that they talk in detail about what it is that obscures the way, what it is that obscures, what it is that makes people obstructed from approaching the truth. They'll talk about that. But what the truth is, there's nothing to say. No words can reach it. And no words can reach it because it's not anything in particular. There are basically three doors to liberation. In the Zen tradition, there are three ways in. One is that it's empty. It's empty of own being. Shunyata. It's one of the doors into the way is through this. The emptiness of things, the emptiness of self. Another door in is that it is wishless. So you cannot enter specifically by desire. You cannot enter directly by desire. The way in is wishless. It has no particular preference. And that place of no preference is where you enter. And the third gate or door in is it's signless. Signless laksana was the term that was used by Kokyo. Laksana means characteristic or quality or aspect. The way in has no particular aspect, no particular quality, no particular mark, no particular There's not a sign on the door that says that's the way in. Because there's no particular way in, no specific way in, that means every mark, every aspect has the potential of being the way in. Every flower, or even the space around the flower, can be your way in. Even your trouble, even your leaking can be the way in. It has no particular aspect. It has no particular wish, or it has no particular, it is empty. These are the three gates or doors to the way in, to liberation. So it's interesting that Buddhism, and particularly Zen Buddhism, does not talk about enlightenment, does not talk about realization, does not talk about awakening, but they do talk in detail about what obstructs it.
Usually you think of Manjushri as a pretty smart guy. And so he got reprimanded.
He did, and he got, and the story kind of goes on that after he did this leaking, this particular bit of leaking as Buddha's attendant, he got thrown into hell. For making this mistake. I mean, this, you know, this is just a story. Got thrown into hell. And he kind of figured out what was going on, and he became very wise, and he helped all the people in the hell realm to kind of wake up. And he was the teacher for all the people in the hell realm. And after that, he became a bodhisattva of wisdom.
I have a question. So you said there are two ways leaking can happen. One is from the bottom, and the other one is by overflowing.
Overflowing, yeah.
You can tell me about the difference. What's the difference, and not physically, but in terms of behavior or...
Like an example or something.
Yeah.
Well, here's a kind of leaking. Say a person got a lot of attention for doing something,
mm-hmm.
and started to doubt his ability to fulfill the expectations of others, and became afraid, and started to lose energy, and become worried or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He would leak out of the bottom of his being by this worry, by this concern about his self-worth. It's another form of egotism, you could say. He's concerned about himself, but he's concerned about not being good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And he would leak out the bottom. He'd become afraid, and he would become scared. He would leak out the bottom of his being. Or he could say, or another way of leaking out of the top is he could think, "Oh, I'm this wonderful person. People have given me a lot of attention." And I'm really great. I'm just wonderful. I'm the king. And he would puff up, and he would just flood his environment and his social environment with his self-importance, and he would kind of leak out the bottom, make a mess, make another kind of mess. You know, both are messy. Both are kind of making trouble or making a mess.
So
The Manjushri's case was more of a overflowing type of view.
He misspoke, you could say, in the story. He said, here's my teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, and oh, by the way, he's got it all figured out. So pay attention. You know, here's the truth, and it's by the way, it's all thusness. And so he kind of made a mistake in the story, but it was actually a very good mistake, because it was a great mistake. Actually, it was a wonderful mistake, because the story, you know, if it happened, the story came forward, and the story was a great teaching, and it was a great event that he was able to leak in this particular way and kind of help people in the hell realm, help people in his own hell realm to kind of come forward. So it's good for us when we look at our own obscurations, our own trouble, to see that our trouble, our difficulties, are kind of our teachers as well. Like this.
Another way of looking at this is sort of picking off from your last thing about the good mistake, you know, that it really worked out well, is that there was this was all a setup between Buddha and Manjushri, and you know,
stage.
And because when Manjushri strikes the gravel and sets up the Buddha, you know, the Buddha's message, their message, was, you know, there's nothing to say about it. There's no words. Don't meddle it with it by anybody saying any words, not even Buddha. There's nothing Buddha can say about it. So that's calling attention to the not meddling, the emptiness, the wordlessness of the Dharma. Conspiracy theory.
So they figured this all out in the back room.
But he was sent to hell anyway because he wanted to get the wisdom there.
You were talking about several ways of leaking, and one is, you mentioned, was wishing. And hoping, I would assume, is part of that. And is a way not to leak, just to fundamentally trust.
In the sense of having a desire, having a particular maybe desirelessness is maybe a better description of that aspect. To not have a preference for one thing or another, to not have a particular, say if you have a particular view, to not have a bias for this view, excluding that view, to actually, instead of holding that wish or that desire very tightly, to hold it, you know, to hold it lightly, or to actually realize that beyond your desire, or beyond your wish, or beyond your aspiration, to have a kind of confidence or trust, like you said, that things can take care of themselves, that things are totally interdependent and mutually supportive and mutually functioning together, that you don't necessarily have to fix anything or everything, that it's not necessarily dependent on you, or it's not necessarily dependent on itself. It's not necessarily dependent on being better or on being worse. To have to relax or to let go of the desire to change or fix something or anything. That place, that wishless place, that place of no desire, where you don't want it to be better or you don't want it to be worse, where there's still having a self that wants things to be better or wants things to be different, still knowing that that exists, to enter into a situation where you allow things to also just be as they are, or to be different from your view, from your wish, you can enter that way, you can enter the gate that way.
So they're given a way to problem solve in a way that, for example, my truck wouldn't start. So there's not just a strong desire to get it to start, but a need. And so then I can hold on to a fixed view that it's this that's wrong with it. And I go and bring 20 tools to it, and nothing works. It doesn't work. It doesn't. And then finally I sit back and I look at it as it is, and it turns out, why don't I just check the battery cables?
Was that it?
Let me see if that fixes it.
This is a true story, by the way.
And so a lot of times you can work yourselves into a frenzy on how you're going to fix something, but to rest and watch, then maybe the weaving brocade and how it can unfold arises for you.
I think in specifics like that, that's a very good example of how things can function in specific issues, that you can also have a desire to make some change, or make a desire to fix something, but also you can relax around that, but I think you can do that. I think you can apply that in a big sense to the whole of life, because we have a kind of will to live. We have a will to be, and our will to live has to do with being unique, being separate, with our own personal survival. And there's all kinds of desire. That's a desire realm. We're wrapped up with our unique and individual sense of self-sustaining, you know, It's part of our, we're wired that way, you could say. And yet we can enter, we can expand that. We can enter into a something that's also wishless, that has no desire, that is free of that desire, and make it, you could call it bigger, make it broader. But you know,
and that the truck is just a metaphor. I've been there so many times that you describe taking things apart, putting them back together weeks later. What I've found is not a lot of large percentage, but that it's simpler than I perceive it. But some things I think are difficult for me with just letting them be some things, many things. But some one thing that seems to reoccur is violence, and to not to allow that to take place and not do anything to fix it somehow, to intervene and take and find uses or can use most of my faculties to know when it's appropriate, when it's necessary,
when an appropriate response is necessary. Is that what you mean? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't see not doing anything as a.
Well, I don't think like these three doors don't necessarily say don't do anything or just remain passive. So there's always an appropriate response to a situation, and if the response is based on a very small and narrow view, then violence could be a response to violence could be met with simply more violence.
For example, on that note, verbal violence, I've found with some particular people, I need to actually exert myself in a verbal tone to counter the verbal violence, so that I'm heard, right? And it kind of like dissipates itself. If I don't do anything, say nothing, don't react in a way, respond in a way, it's in a similar vein as what's directing at me, it will continue and escalate. In fact, when the violence becomes more intense, if I don't counter it, response as opposed to reaction, I think, has been what I mean by tapping into most of my facilities to be responsive, which is not so easy. And the animal comes out when I'm being attacked.
Do you bite?
Pardon? Pardon me?
Do you bite?
Do I fight?
Bite.
Bite. Sure. second bite.
Yeah.
I don't like this feeling. And I try to avoid it on one hand. But not doing something in certain instances is not the right tactic. See, it appears I have to do something. I have to try to fix it, or it will expand and be more violent.
There's a lot of, when we talked about leaking, about asravas, obscurations, there's also a leaking of any sort of expression could be a form of leaking. It's how it's applied, but contraction or withdrawal is like leaking out of the bottom of the bucket, as we just talked about. So to not meet something, to not meet an experience or a person or a situation as it is a, to pull back from that is a form of it's a form of leaking as well. So I think that's what you're talking about. So you don't in a circumstance where you're confronted with a dramatic situation like that.
I like Alan Watts when he said it was the heebie-jeebies actually the problem.
The what?
The heebie-jeebies.
So what's the definition of heebie-jeebies?
It's like when you cut yourself by, or somehow you cut yourself and you go, it's this reactionary mode to this pain. That's the problem, anyway. I think it's what he's getting. It's the heebie-jeebie of it, you know, and the animal, really, I think, in some ways, seems to me the instinct to defend or to counter, and that seems to be somewhat where I'm saying that draws from a lot of my faculties. To stay in a responsive mode, to realize what I'm. Oh. It's not really that bad as my animal parts of me. It's not really that bad. Yeah, my foot's fallen asleep, but it's a sensation, and then what, you know, it's not really as much as I assume or I'm thinking, feeling it about. So. Some situations it calls for me to raise my voice and insists on me in a certain way to counter with a similar mode. Is violence, verbal violence, it requires me sometimes to make it dissipate, to participate in it. Hmm. It's not something that's comforting or that I desire, but I don't see an alternative really in certain instances.
Thank you. I think